This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. In today's program, a special report on North Korea following the death of dear leader Kim Jong-il. I'm Robert Knight in New York. The world's capital scrambled today to calculate the nuclear, economic, and social impact of Pyongyang's Sunday night announcement of what was described as the train-bound sudden death of Kim Jong-il, the late leader of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea's Workers' Party and National Defense Committee. The death was officially attributed to heart failure as a result of stress and fatigue. Kim had been in declining health due to presumed pancreatic cancer, but the ostensibly sudden death of the 69-year-old leader occurred at a critical time for North Korean diplomacy. Kim's alleged Saturday morning heart attack came just hours before a major announcement would have been scheduled for today. Multilateral talks in Beijing had just secured North Korea's agreement to suspend uranium processing in exchange for 250,000 tons of food from the United States. Those supplies would augment or replace previously abrogated food aid promises from Washington. A suspension of uranium reprocessing would have opened broader talks with Washington, leading to more negotiations with a six-nation regional contact group. Lesser noted in mainstream coverage thus far is consideration of how the more food for less uranium deal would have aided the South Korean nuclear industry, which wants its own uranium enrichment program to offset a national glut of nuclear waste. The Pyongyang deal, if it indeed comes to pass and remains in effect, would clear the way for Seoul to reprocess its own uranium. The United States has said that South Korea cannot do that until a deal is made on North Korean uranium reprocessing. Kim's death came mere weeks before the 1974 nuclear treaty between the United States and South Korea came up for renegotiation at the beginning of the year 2012. Meanwhile, in Pyongyang, the question is who, among the military and Communist Party leadership, will control the government. Jong-il designated leadership succession to his relatively inexperienced third son, Kim Jong-un. Pyongyang officials today called him the great successor to the dear leader. But the younger Kim may, nevertheless, be standing in the shadow of a few North Korean bureaucrats, including Jang Song-taek, the brother-in-law of the late leader. A recent confidential State Department cable obtained by WikiLeaks addressed the succession and policy prospects in the context of North Korea's nuclear family issues.
Assistant Secretary Campbell discusses North Korean future with experts. Embassy, Seoul, South Korea. February 18, 2010. Confidential. Summary. A group of five South Korean opinion leaders and experts on North Korea issues told Assistant Secretary Kurt Campbell on February 3, 2010, that it was difficult to predict whether Kim Jong-il's youngest son Kim Jong-un would be able to succeed his father without sparking instability in the North. They agreed that Kim Jong-il's brother-in-law Jang Song-taek would prove a strong rival for the younger Kim and would probably be tempted to challenge him. End summary. Succession in progress but success in doubt. Assistant Secretary Kurt Campbell met on February 3 with South Korean opinion makers to hear their views on the future of North Korea. The experts agreed that regime succession was fully underway and that the North Korean people had accepted the process. Kim Sung-min, representative for Radio Free North Korea, said a North Korean diplomat in Beijing told him that the foreign ministry had instructed all of its overseas missions to, quote, lay the foundation for leadership change in Pyongyang, unquote. Most of the experts believe the challenge for Kim Jong-il's youngest son and designated heir, Kim Jong-un, would most likely come after his father died. The group agreed that Kim Jong-il's brother-in-law and right-hand man Jang Song-taek was spearheading the succession drive and would be a rival for power once Kim Jong-un's father died, but the group was split on the younger Kim's prospects for holding on to power. Kim Sung-min believed it would be difficult for Jang to wrest power from the younger Kim once the succession process was complete. National Assemblywoman Park Sun-young suggested it was unclear whether Jang would be content to control the younger Kim from behind the curtain, or would challenge him directly for outright control. Doubts about younger Kim's experience. There were many reasons to doubt that Kim Jong-un would be able to successfully fend off challenges to his control after his father died, according to Han Ki-hong, president of the Daily NK NGO. Han noted that Kim Jong-il had 20 years of experience as an official of the Korean Workers' Party before his father died. Furthermore, Kim Jong-il had the benefit of years of guidance from his father after he had been officially anointed in 1980 to eventually succeed him. By contrast, Kim Jong-un had very limited experience and might not get much direct guidance before Kim Jong-il dies. Even now, Han said, it was not clear that Kim Jong-il's health was good enough to exercise the faculties necessary for day-to-day management of state affairs. Given the limited opportunity the younger Kim had to gain experience, Han doubted his ability to solidify his position in the party and win the unwavering support of Pyongyang's power elites. China complicates the endgame. The experts agreed that China's obsession with North Korea's stability at all costs was clearly and fundamentally at odds with US and South Korea interests. Given a choice between reaching out to Seoul or Beijing, Park believed that Pyongyang elites would reflexively look to China for support if they believed they needed help in maintaining stability. The Seoul option would be unacceptable because of the US-South Korea alliance and concerns over becoming subservient to Seoul. China, on the other hand, would gladly provide support with few or no strings attached, just to maintain North Korea as an independent entity, she maintained. Han Ki-hong noted that although Washington had a keen interest in both denuclearization and human rights, the U.S. stake in North Korea was minimal compared to that of China by virtue of its proximity to the North. China did not share American perspectives on these two key issues, considering them somewhat abstract. Rather, Beijing was concerned about what it considered to be more concrete issues, such as a potential flood of economic migrants, and broader social unrest on its immediate border. Reaching the people and close cooperation are key. Negating Chinese influence over the long term, Park Sun-young said that while she understood the importance of the nuclear issue for Washington, she urged more focus on human rights issues that would convince the populace that we are on their side.
A recent confidential State Department cable courtesy of WikiLeaks regarding North Korean succession. Much of America's mainstream commercial reporting on North Korea has been incompletely contextual or alarmist or sometimes xenophobic. Therefore, today on 5 o'clock Shadow, we take a deeper look at North Korea's national perspective and its nuclear programs in light of recent history. Dr. Siegfried Hecker is a nuclear scientist with Stanford University's Center for International Security and Cooperation. He's traveled frequently to Pyongyang and has personally inspected North Korean nuclear facilities annually over the past 7 years. Dr. Hecker recently reported his findings in a Google Tech Talk titled North Korea Nuclear Proliferation, Negotiation, and the Human Aspects of an Estranged Country.
So let me start with, how did North Korea get the bomb? It began with the Soviets' Atoms for Peace program. The Atoms for Peace program was initiated by President Eisenhower in the United States in 1953, and the essence was that at that time only the U.S., the Russians, and the Brits had nuclear weapons. All of the technology was highly classified, and President Eisenhower said, we will share nuclear technology with those countries in the world who are willing to forswear nuclear weapons, in other words, not to pursue nuclear weapons, but instead develop atoms for peace, for civilian purposes. The Soviets also followed suit, and so as you might imagine, since the world was divided into two, sort of U.S. and Soviet blocs, the Soviets then helped the countries in Eastern Europe and many of the others, including China initially, and including North Korea, to develop peaceful nuclear energy. So the North Koreans were trained in Soviet universities. They were trained in Soviet nuclear centers. The Soviets built the first small research reactor in Yongbyon, which is still currently the nuclear facility in North Korea. It's about 90 kilometers north of Pyongyang. That was the beginning, but it was strictly meant to help the North Koreans with peaceful applications of atomic energy. However, for those of you who know much about Korea, they eventually trust no one. They want to go their own path, and they did go their own path in the nuclear arena. And in the 1970s, having learned much, having set up their own nuclear engineering programs, nuclear physics programs at their university, they decided and laid out a very ambitious program for nuclear reactors. And at the same time, in my opinion, they actually chose a path to the North Korean nuclear reactor program that would also allow them to develop the option for nuclear weapons. And I will say more about that. And then for a number of very interesting but very complex political reasons, in the early 1990s, when the North Korean world first came apart, that was the first time they actually worked directly with the United States in order to take this nuclear program that they were building up and essentially freeze the bomb component of that program. The reason they reached across the United States was that, as you remember, in the end of 1991, the Soviet Union came apart. When that happened, here was a very strong and supportive ally of North Korea. Not only the Soviet Union, but the Soviet bloc. And you find today strong connections from Eastern Europe to North Korea. And the Russians essentially deserted them overnight. And so the financial help, the technical help, everything that was there beforehand went away. The second major bloc that dealt with North Korea was China. But this was also a time when China was worried much more about its own economic rise than it was about the ideology around the world. And the Chinese actually hooked up with the South Koreans because they felt that that was a better way to go economically. So North Korea at that point felt it really had no friends left, and it actually reached across the United States in order to try to strike a deal. Well, that was difficult to do, but eventually a deal was struck in 1994. The essence of that deal was that the North Koreans would freeze their plutonium program, and again, I'll tell you more about that. In return, the U.S. would actually make sure the North Koreans get two light water reactors, the ones that are better for electricity than for bombs, and that we would normalize relationships with them. Well, it turns out that was a rocky marriage from 1994 to 2002, and in 2002 the marriage came apart because that's the first time the Bush administration actually sent representatives to Pyongyang, and instead of sort of holding out the peace branch, they accused the North Koreans of having cheated on this agreement. North Koreans walked away, and in 2002 actually began bomb production. And then that continued for the rest of the Bush administration. And indeed, along the way, the North Koreans not only were able to extract plutonium from their reactor products, but they actually conducted a first test in 2006 and a second test in May of 2009. So the North Korean nuclear story is a story of 50 years in the making. It's not something that you do overnight. It's 50 years in the making, and it vacillated back and forth as to whether it was more civilian or more defense. And I've written a paper on this subject published in the journal Daedalus in winter of 2010. So let me just give you a little primer on the bomb, because in order for you to appreciate what plutonium means, what highly enriched uranium means, you need at least to know these essentials. There are essentially two paths to the bomb, and if you look at the periodic table, the two practical fissile materials are uranium, and actually only one isotope of uranium, that is 235, that occurs only 0.7% of natural uranium, and the other one being plutonium, which is principally man-made from reactors. And so the two paths are, let's look on the right-hand side first, and that is you take the natural fissile material, uranium-235, and you essentially throw away all of the rest of what you find in Mother Nature, that is the 238 isotope of uranium. You do that by a process called enrichment, essentially just concentrating one isotope. As you might imagine, that's somewhat difficult to do because they're both uranium, they both have the same chemical properties in essence, so you have to take advantage of one being just a little heavier than the other. And that's what you do in a centrifuge. So you turn the uranium into a gas, you spin it very, very fast. The light stuff stays on the inside, the heavy stuff goes to the outside, and you just keep doing this over and over and over. And that's where the term centrifuges, cascades come from. And so that was what was done actually during the Manhattan Project days in the United States. We did it by a different technique called gaseous diffusion, but today the technique of choice is the centrifuge. And what you see on the right-hand side are just rows of these centrifuges. The second path to the bomb is you actually start with the natural uranium or slightly enriched uranium, and you put it in a reactor, and you start the neutron reaction, and you fission the uranium 235 atoms. That makes a bunch of fission products, and it makes a bunch of neutrons. 238 picks up a neutron, and through a few decays becomes plutonium. And it turns out that plutonium is an even better bomb material than uranium-235, except now you not only have to make it in a reactor, which is the top diagram on your left-hand side, but then you have to extract it from the reactor products, from the fission products. And that you do chemically, and that's what we call reprocessing. You do that in the reprocessing facility. Now, it turns out for the uranium-235, you can make a rather simple bomb. And that is you just take two subcritical hemispheres and you put them in a gun and you shoot them together very rapidly. Okay, when you do that, in essence, if you do it right, that was the Hiroshima device, around 13 or so kilotons, 13,000 ton TNT equivalent. It destroyed a city. One plane, one bomb destroyed a city. That's because of this nuclear stuff. When you split the nucleus, you get a factor of millions in the energy gain compared to all the other chemical techniques. And so that's why nuclear is so special. And not only do you get that in nuclear energy, but you also get it in a bomb, if you do it right, or if you do it wrong, depending on your point of view. So this gun assembly works for for highly enriched uranium, for a bomb that's typically 80 to 90% enriched. It doesn't work for plutonium for very good nuclear physics reasons I won't get into. So for plutonium instead, you have to use what we call the implosion device. And that is you have a subcritical mass of plutonium, pack explosives around it like a soccer ball. You put detonators around and you try to implode it all very symmetrically to drive it to supercriticality, and then it blows up. That's Nagasaki. Takes about 6 kilograms for the implosion device of plutonium, takes a few tens of kilograms in highly enriched uranium. You can also use the implosion device with highly enriched uranium in the implosion device, but a much simpler way to go, and this would be the nuclear terrorism lecture, would be to use this gun assembly. So most countries that have nuclear weapons today actually pursued both of these. And in the United States, we did that in the Manhattan Project. Okay, so with that as the primer then, let me just say that North Korea has mastered the entire plutonium fuel cycle. Fuel cycle meaning everything from the time you dig it out of the ground, you mine it. And by the way, they have significant quantities of uranium ore in North Korea. None in South Korea, but quite a bit in North Korea. So they know how to mine it, mill it, convert it, and then make fuel. The type of reactors that they chose to build are called gas-cooled graphite-moderated reactors. They're patterned after ones that the Brits built in the early 1950s, the first one of which was called the Hall reactor. Turns out the benefits of this type of reactor is you can feed in natural uranium. You don't have to enrich it a little bit first, as you do with light water reactors. So that means the North Koreans, since they did this on their own, I mean, they copied the Calder-Hall reactor, but they did it strictly on their own with no more help at that time from the Soviets, from the Chinese, from nobody. So they didn't need enrichment. They were able to make their own fuel. You use metallic fuel for these reactors instead of ceramic fuels because you need higher uranium density, since all you have is 0.7% of the fissile isotope. And so they know how to make fuel. Second, they build reactors. They finished one, the small one, 5 megawatt electric. That's very small, doesn't produce much electricity, but it produces one bomb's worth of plutonium a year, if you can extract it. And so that they've had that reactor operating since 1986, off and on over the years. They had a 50 megawatt within 1 or 2 years of completion when they signed this agreement with the Americans in 1994. That was then halted. And I'll tell you later through my visits, I found out it's dead. It can't be resurrected. They had a 200 megawatt electric reactor. That actually would have produced quite a bit of electricity for North Korea. That was just in the beginning stages of construction. They halted that. That's also not salvageable today. The back end, the reprocessing facility, it's just a complicated chemical engineering facility where you deal with all of this hot nuclear stuff that you've heard about related to Japan, except in this type of facility, you handle it in hot cells with remote handling where that radioactivity is essentially separated from the workers. They know how to do that. They patterned that facility after a facility in Belgium. Again, they built it by themselves. North Koreans are terrific engineers. They built this whole complex then by themselves. So that's the Yongbyon nuclear complex. So what do they have? It's sort of the bottom line slide. On the basis of my visits and my discussions with the North Koreans, and on the basis of looking with Google Earth as to whether there's a plume coming out of the cooling tower of the Yongbyon reactor, we pretty much know how many days it's operated. We can estimate what power level they operate at, and we know what sort of reactor they have, what fuel they put in, and you can calculate how much plutonium they've made. So this is actually the part we know the best. And then some of the holes they filled in my personal discussions with them. So they have today 24 to 42 kilograms, sort of 4 to 8 bombs worth. So, and they indeed do have the bomb because they exploded two of them. One didn't work so well. The second one, as far as I'm concerned, was successful. Now, my view is that since they've had, let's say, 1.5 tests, the bombs that they have are most likely primitive bombs. In other words, like our Nagasaki bomb, which had to be delivered, you know, was huge, 10,000 pounds, had to be delivered by a plane. It's very difficult to miniaturize these things, and it takes nuclear testing, takes computational capability, and I just don't believe they've had the opportunity to get there yet. Now, they have no plutonium in the pipeline, even though they could still run that reactor. They've chosen not to run the reactor. It's an interesting part of the North Korean story. They shut it down the last time in July of 2007. They've not restarted it. However, they could, again, based on my visits, it would take them about 6 months to get the reactor up and operating. And the reprocessing facility, it's in cold standby, it's in standby, but they could operate it also. Now, uranium enrichment, we've suspected them of doing uranium enrichment over decades, but we never really had the smoking gun. And that was the story of my last visit in November of 2010. They finally decided to show me what they've done in uranium enrichment. Quite frankly, I was expecting not much, sort of a couple of dozen centrifuges, maybe in a garage somewhere. And instead, I'll show you that they now have a small industrial-scale centrifuge facility. And I'll tell you what it's for, and then I'll also tell you what the potential problems are. I mentioned that here is even though they've built this current facility that I saw to make low-enriched uranium, that stuff that goes into light water reactors, sort of 3 to 5% enriched in the isotope 235 instead of 80 to 90, which is what you would use for bombs. And so we don't know about the highly enriched uranium weapons because this is a new twist that we simply didn't expect for them to have come this far. Will there be another nuclear test? When we were just working in the plutonium world, I thought maybe one more. But as you can see, with that much plutonium, if they would do 6 tests, we'd be finished. You know, the problem would be solved. I thought they might do one more. Now, if they make highly enriched uranium, we may see a highly enriched uranium test. So we're not sure. So how do we know all this stuff? I hope that shows up okay, that you can at least see photos. From my 6 first trips to North Korea, I've taken 7 altogether, in 2000, and what's really interesting in working with the North Koreans, as you might imagine, they only let me in if they feel that I can do them some good. I mean, because otherwise, why let me into their nuclear facilities? So for each of these visits, they've had a very special message. Now, you might wonder, how do I get to go to North Korea? Well, I don't go as a U.S. government official. It's what we call track two diplomacy, non-official, non-governmental. Now, I worked for Los Alamos for 34 years, but one of the beauties of working for Los Alamos, I was actually an employee of the University of California because it ran the laboratory for the government. So I was never a government employee, but the North Koreans know I have a good link to the U.S. government. I mean, that's what they want to use. So they sent me a message with each of these visits. The first one and the last one were the most fascinating ones. The first one, I actually show a picture. So you've heard about spent fuel pools at Fukushima Daiichi, I'm sure. This is the spent fuel pool, and we're looking down into the spent fuel pool in Yongbyon because they were trying to tell me that the fuel rods that used to be stored in there that held the plutonium that's been sitting there for 8 years is now gone, and they've extracted the plutonium. It wasn't quite that easy to figure out, but the bottom line was one, when they showed me their reprocessing facility, they sat me down in a conference room, then they said, well, Dr. Hecker, we've now shown you our deterrent. And I said, deterrent? Now, wait a minute, you know. I mean, you showed me the reactor reprocessing facility, it looks like the fuel rods are gone. You know, you have that, but, you know, I haven't seen anything. They said, well, how would you like to see our product? And I'm in the conference room now, right? And I said, you mean the plutonium? And they said, well, yes. I said, well, I've worked at Los Alamos for 34 years. Sure, bring it in. And so they did, into the conference room. And a metal box about this big, and I opened it up. They opened it up. Inside was a white wooden box. They slid off the top, and there sat two jars, two marmalade jars, believe it or not, screw-on tops. And inside was a plutonium powder, and the other one had plutonium metal. They said, that's our product. So I finally wound up, I didn't have any detectors. I had nothing with me because I figured I'd never get in if I bring anything. So I had my eyes, and finally I asked them if I could hold it because plutonium is very heavy. The density of unalloyed plutonium is 20 grams per cc. And it also should be slightly warm because it is radioactive. Now, when I tell my students that story, you know, they all say, oh, my God, you know, he held the plutonium. How come he's still alive? Well, for those I'm sure you know, the plutonium is only alpha active, and so as long as you have it in a plastic bag or in a jar or whatever, it doesn't get you. You don't want to breathe it or inhale it. Digest it. And so the plutonium was okay, and it was plutonium. And so each one of these visits, they had a certain message that they wanted to get across. And over these 7 years, I've been able to visit their nuclear facilities four times, talk to their nuclear people, especially in each of those visits, and get a reasonably good sense of what they have in the plutonium program. That was the story in 2004. In 2007, what you see here is actually a glove box, and I'm in the middle of that crew on the lower left to actually see where they made the plutonium, and that was fascinating. I learned a lot just from going through the plutonium laboratory. The one on the right, they actually showed that they had disabled most of their plutonium facilities in 2008, which they did. And then we come to visit number seven, which was just this last November. When I arrived there, they said, we will convert this center, you know, from a plutonium facility to a light water reactor and pilot enrichment facility. So that's what we're doing. And then they also reminded me, they said, you know, no, we said that in 2009 after, again, they had an altercation this time with the Obama administration. They walked away from everything again, from these six-party talks, the four neighbors, North Korea and the U.S. And they said, we're going to do our own light water reactor, and that, of course, means we have to actually do uranium enrichment because that's what you need for light water reactor fuel. And they said, nobody believed us, including you, Dr. Hecker. And so we're going to show you. So they did. So they first took me on the left-hand side. The arrow points to where they were just beginning the construction of the light water reactor. on the right-hand side, the building with the blue roof, which, interestingly enough, no one had picked up until that time. It was only after I told people I was in this building that then when they looked down with digital globe and they saw this blue roof, I said, yeah, that's the one. That's where I was. And that's where the uranium enrichment was being done. So with the light water reactor, particularly in light of what happened now in Japan, and I wrote this all before Japan ever happened, I've published several papers on my visit to North Korea, what I found and what concerns me. And this was one of my biggest concerns. When I saw how they were constructing that small, it's a small light water reactor, experimental light water reactor, it would not meet U.S. or Western safety standards. The way that they were constructing this concrete containment shell with a small concrete mixer, you know, in the winter time is just not the way to construct the reactor. They also did it with a whole new reactor design team. It's tough to forge that stainless steel. It's even tougher to go ahead and weld it in place. They did well with their old reactor, but this is very different. It's a different technology. And what I used to say, the Western world learned, in fact, the whole world learned from the examples of Three Mile Island and then Chernobyl. And nuclear power operators around the world got together and said, look, we have to run these things safely because otherwise we will have no nuclear power. And they did. They had a fantastic safety record for all those years. Then, of course, Fukushima Daiichi happened, you know, where a natural catastrophe was much beyond anything that the system was designed for. And the one thing, at least, that I've learned from that, and the lessons learned will yet to be drawn because, of course, the situation is not yet completely stabilized. But one of the lessons is for sure, you have to have technical expertise in country. You know, both the authorities and the technical people have to know what they're doing in terms of emergency response. You have to have the right equipment available. You know, I'm sure you followed that. You know, with the fire trucks, the hoses, the sea salt spraying, and all of these things. Well, I'm going to give you examples of North Korean preparedness for natural disasters, and it doesn't give you a lot of faith. So I was mostly concerned about the safety of the reactor, and I made this view graph long before Japan. One could also be concerned that this light water reactor could make plutonium, but it turns out it wouldn't make any sense to make plutonium that way because they already have a reactor that makes good bomb-grade plutonium. Light water reactors make bad bomb-grade plutonium. And, of course, what they now have is they can say, look, we have a light water reactor. We need to enrich because that's what we need to do for nuclear energy. And so that's what they say. This is a photo I took in August of 2007 as we were leaving Yongbyon after it rained, torrential rains, all day long. And if you look carefully, what you see is on the other side of the river, there's a whole parade of people from children to adults that are carrying rocks and sand in dishpans up to the road to throw it on the road so that we could get back out of there and back to Pyongyang. That was their emergency relief and disaster management. And it turns out they lost several hundred people in North Korea during that flood. They had about 50 centimeters of rain in various parts of the country. They lost 10% of their crops, in essence, because they don't have much in terms of emergency relief and disaster management. Okay, now just to give you a little bit of what was associated with this uranium enrichment, since it was a big surprise, in the middle on the right-hand side is Ambassador Lee Gun, the second in charge of the six-party talks, and he said, Dr. Hecker, you will have very big news when you go to Yongbyon. I still didn't know what it was. The big news was something like this, and I had to make this up because they wouldn't let me take any photos this time. This is a slightly doctored photo from one of the U.S. centrifuge plants, but that's in essence what this centrifuge facility looked like. It was truly mind-boggling. You know, about 2,000 centrifuges I looked up from the second floor of an observation window, and it's just this beautiful rows of centrifuges three of them in pairs. And not only that, but the whole facility looked totally different than all the other facilities at Yongbyon. The other facilities looked sort of Soviet 50s or 60s style. And just to give you an example, on the lower right is the reactor control room that I visited several times, sort of Soviet style. And what you see on the upper left is actually flat, you know, computers, flat screens. This was in Kim Il-sung University e-library. And the control room of the centrifuge facility looked like that, not like the old control room. So it had four computers, flat panel monitors, LED displays. It was just ultra-modern. I had never seen anything like that in North Korea. Okay, so the centrifuge facility, I'll just go through this very quickly because I'm sure most of you are not interested in the details, but they did have 2,000 centrifuges, and it looked like they had what we call P2, sort of the second generation of centrifuges. Turns out the faster you spin these centrifuges, the more separation that you get. And so you have to use very high-strength material so they don't come apart. The first generation was aluminum. The second generation is what we call Mariging steel. The third generation would actually be carbon-carbon composites. So their throughput is 8,000 kilograms separative work units per year. What does that mean? Well, it would mean they have enough capacity to make the low-enriched uranium fuel for that little reactor. The problem is, as I'll point out in just a minute, it's also enough to make one bomb's worth of highly enriched uranium if they plummet that way. And they had previously told me over and over they don't have a uranium enrichment program, but they do. So in American diplomatic circles, you know, what you saw, as soon as I came back, the word was, see, they lied. And my answer was, well, of course they lied. I mean, they've lied many times, you know, and many countries lie, of course, in that whole messy diplomatic process. But those diplomats in the U.S. that actually work with them that had specifically heard, we don't have uranium enrichment, well, they do. For those of us in the proliferation business, the most interesting aspect is how did they get it? Because unlike for the reactors, where I told you they made them indigenously, essentially they had all the materials that they needed, for the enrichment, they do not have all the materials. They do not have all the components, and we believe they still cannot make those today. So they had to purchase them from somewhere. And they did, but it turns out there were plenty of greedy European businessmen who were willing to sell them things. And the Germans tried to sell them aluminum alloys. The Russians did sell them aluminum alloys. We don't know where they got the Mariging steel, most likely from the Russians. Again, not through legal barter, but they got them. Where did they get the frequency inverters? Where did they get the bearings? Where did they get many of the other components? Well, the same place that A.Q. Khan, the father of the Pakistani bomb, got them from all over the world through a very complicated procurement ring. It looks like the North Koreans have run a very similar ring. And in fact, A.Q. Khan himself actually helped out the North Koreans. We know that because President Musharraf, in his memoir, actually said he gave them a starter kit. It was that starter kit that I was expecting to see, but instead, much like the North Koreans have done with everything else, they take whatever they can get, and then they build things themselves, and they do it quite well. There's also, I used to be concerned about possible cooperation with Iran, but from what I saw, North Korea is ahead of the Iranian centrifuge program. The Iranians have played with centrifuges since 1987, and they still don't have the separative work capacity that the North Koreans did. This is just to show you that what the North Koreans told me is that, oh, yes, of course we have uranium enrichment now. We just started this program last year. And it turns out that's just not possible. You know, it takes years and years and years, and most likely they've been at it for decades. But the building that they put it in, and I've got this split photo, the one with the blue roof, is up now, and it looked like where you see it before, where I showed the fuel rod fab facility. That's the building I was in a couple of years ago, and it didn't look anything like this. So they gutted it, moved it in, but what it means is they had a centrifuge facility operating someplace else, and then they duplicated it and moved it in here within the last year's time. So what's the threat from the centrifuge program? itself, it's required for LWR, so they actually have a good story. You know, we tried to get an LWR from you, the Americans. You wouldn't give it to us. We decided to make our own, and if we make an LWR, we now need to enrich, and so we did. Well, but the problem is the same technology also then can be used to make highly enriched uranium, and that's the Iran problem. That's in essence, Iran has justified its program since it was discovered in 2002 that they need to do it for their own light water reactor program. The problem is that we also suspect them of being capable to go to highly enriched uranium. So those 2,000 centrifuges could make enough reactor fuel, or they could make 40 kilograms of 90% enriched. Now, let's also look, for the most part, you know, we hear in the United States that all of our diplomatic attempts with North Korea has been totally unsuccessful. It turns out I don't agree with that. Because if we would have left the North Koreans alone in the early 1990s, continue on their path to build all three of those reactors that I showed you, they could have a couple of hundred bombs today, not a handful. That's a huge, huge difference. So what did they not get? They never finished those bigger reactors. They could have 100-plus weapons. And they wanted electricity, and they got essentially nothing. If you add up all the electricity since 1986 to today, they produce by nuclear power. It's 23 days worth of an LWR equivalent. So you could say, if you look at this through North Korean glasses, you know, we work with these Americans and we got nothing. Now, we did get a handful of bombs, and of course for the regime, that's awfully important. So why did they get the bomb? Well, why do countries get the bomb? It's usually three reasons: for security, domestic reasons, and international reasons. Security, no question, is the driving force. You know, we're still at war, technically, with North Korea. The war was only stopped by an armistice in 1953. We have no peace treaty. And every visit that I've had, you know, I'm reminded of the hostile policies of the United States toward North Korea. And so when they explain why we had to get the bomb, of course, you know, it's easy for them to say it's your fault, it's the Americans' fault, your hostile policy. We feel threatened by you. And, of course, they have a few things to point to, you know, like Saddam Hussein, for example. And the lesson for them was, you know, he didn't have the bomb and he's gone. There was a very interesting newspaper blurb from the North Koreans referring to the Gaddafi situation in Libya, essentially saying he shouldn't have given up this nuclear stuff in 2003. Look what's happening to him now. So at any rate, of course, they turn these things, you know, in the direction that the regime wants them to be. The domestic reasons, once they got the bomb, then, of course, for domestic reasons, you know, these people in North Korea, if you compare them to South Korea, I mean, they really are destitute. And so they have to sacrifice in their daily lives. They're reminded daily they have to sacrifice. Well, if you have an enemy and if you've got to build a nuclear weapon to keep that enemy out, sort of that justifies the sacrifice. And then internationally, that bomb has bought them an enormous, that handful of bombs. You know, they're not much of a nuclear arsenal, but it has kept the U.S. out. And it does bring U.S., you know, to and the rest to the bargaining table. So it's used as a bargaining chip. So now we know they have the bomb. We know they have some uranium enrichment. So what does it really mean? I personally don't lose a lot of sleep over the fact that they have the bomb. They've had it at least since 2003. They haven't done anything crazy with those bombs. From their standpoint, it's a deterrent to keep the United States out. So the threat from those handful of bombs, I think, currently is low. If they use the bomb, it's all over. I mean, the one thing the regime wants is regime preservation, and they know if they use the bomb anywhere, anytime, it's the end of the regime. So why would they want to use it? Now, if they have a lot more bombs, then I start worrying more. And particularly, so if they would be able to make a lot of highly enriched uranium, which I think they're currently not able to do, that is to make a lot. So if they have 100 bombs, I'm more concerned. But miscalculation or accidents can certainly happen when you play with bombs. Accidents can happen, of course, as we find out in many areas. Uranium enrichment, I used to not be worried about it. Now I worry about it if they have the capacity to make a lot of highly enriched uranium. What I worry mostly about from North Korea is export. In other words, You know, there's one threat of having this nuclear stuff in the hands of the government. It's much worse yet if it gets out of the hands of the government, into the hands of Iran, into the hands of terrorists. And so we know that the North Koreans sell missile technology all over the world, particularly the countries that we're not terribly fond of. We also have examples where they have sold nuclear technologies. I'm going to give you one example of that. But sort of difficult to do plutonium export, to build reactors, although they did one in Syria. It would be much easier to do highly enriched uranium technology, or perhaps to sell highly enriched uranium, because you could use the justification, use highly enriched uranium in research reactors. And so it's actually a civilian export, not a bomb export. So will they give up the bomb? In my opinion, not in the near future, because it's their ticket for regime survival. And unless we're willing to take military action, which we can't force it to give it up. We've tried to squeeze North Korea, but it turns out China doesn't want to squeeze North Korea. They have a very different relationship. Not that the Chinese like the North Koreans having bombs. You know, they prefer the North Koreans not to have bombs, but they're not willing to make the regime come to its knees in order for them to give up the bomb. And that's where we stand today. So without the Chinese, you can't force them to give up the bomb. So what you have to do is, for the time being, unfortunately, we have to live with it. So we should make sure that we reduce the risks and then develop a comprehensive solution. So we have to deal with North Korea the way it is, not the way we'd like it to be. We got to work with China particularly, but also, of course, with South Korea, because in the end, you know, that's the same people. It's the same country. But we've got to contain the threat, even though eventually we'd like a denuclearized Korean peninsula. So what I've been trying to sort of market in Washington is, to me, what makes the most sense is what I call three no's with one yes. The way to reduce the risk is no more bombs, no better bombs, no export. If we could get the North Koreans to agree on that, and particularly get the Chinese to agree to put the squeeze on the North Koreans, not at this point to give up the bomb, but at least to stop increasing the threat. The no better bombs means no testing. So again, if you look with Google Earth, you know, you can see that they're preparing a third test site. You know, the hole's there. We don't know exactly when they're going to do it or what they're going to do, but we'd rather not have them do that test. And so no tests, no more bombs. They're already not producing more plutonium. Now we'd have to make sure they're not producing more highly enriched uranium. The one yes is, you know, it's the insecurity that drives them. And so this whole issue of normalization of relations, what actually needs to be done, and there's no single piece of paper you can sign with the North Koreans. This is a process that's going to take a number of years. Okay, so now, Chris, if I may, maybe I'll run through 5 minutes of just a photo tour through North Korea. Of course, when we talk, and it's important because we see such a different view on U.S. television today, but it's also important that if you're going to try to solve the nuclear issue, you know, we techies always think the solution is technical, but the solution here isn't technical. The technology has to inform the policy. But you have to understand the people, you have to understand the history, you have to understand the culture in order to understand the politics, to understand whether there's any chance of coming to a resolution.
We just heard portions of a recent Google Tech Talk by nuclear analyst Dr. Siegfried S. Hecker of Stanford University's Center for International Security and Cooperation. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And now we close today's program with the most recent statement of North Korea to the United Nations General Assembly this year, as well as a tribute to the late leader Kim Jong-il, performed by the Korean Army Chorus.
Yeah. stable and peaceful environment is a vital prerequisite for the DPRK and its people today in their struggle for economic development. We regret, however, that the Korean Peninsula does not yet enjoy lasting and a stable peace mechanism. The national division imposed by outside forces and the fragile armistice with neither war nor peace have now persisted for more than half a century. This is the stark reality of the Korean Peninsula. Despite the unanimous aspirations and desires of all of the people at home and abroad who strive for peace and stability, the arms build-up and nuclear war exercises continue to be staged one after another against the DPRK in and around the Korean Peninsula. Due to this factor, there is a constant recurring of a dangerous situation on the Korean Peninsula, which is often driven to the brink of war. The prevailing situation not only poses a grave threat to the sovereignty and security of our republic, but also obstructs the efforts of our people for peaceful development. Had it not been for the Songun politics unfolded by the great leader of our people, General Kim Jong-il, and had it not been for our powerful war deterrent, the Korean Peninsula would have been turned into a theater of war scores of times already, and our peaceful economic development unimaginable.
You've been listening to 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacific Radio Network. Engineering by Michael G. Haskins. We welcome your comments, questions, tips, leaks, and suggestions with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.